Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Friday, July 8th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. Thanks to the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, if you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that particular chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've used to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it. Print it off and copy it as often as you'd like to use it over and over again, absolutely free. There's also a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one that you can download and listen to over and over again that can serve as a tutorial for how to apply this tool in various situations, because a number of those shows contain the audio files of people who have called in to ask for help working through the worksheet process itself. And if you have questions or comments, or you'd like help working through a worksheet, or understanding more about the dynamics that make it work as well as it does, you can give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1, or you can send us an email, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And we appreciate when people do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. And our intention with this work is to be of service. The entire reason that Michael and Jeannie spend their own money to maintain the website and pay for the ability to do this internet show and maintain Heartland, which is an intensive center in very southern Missouri, almost Arkansas. All of it with the intention to be of service, to try and help, as Michael would say at various times in the past, to help make these tools available to every mind, heart, and being on the planet, whether they have any money to pay for it or not. So if you have the money to pay for it, if these tools are helping you, feel free to donate. But if you have need of tools that can help transform your life for the better and you don't have money, you're in the right place. This is a set of tools, as I already said in the introduction, some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools. I say that because you can just download them free off the internet or step into the use of the archives of this internet show, which has been going for 11 plus years. And you can get really effective tools for improving your quality of life. And we'd be happy to entertain any comments or questions you have about that. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. Last year we worked through the Course in Miracles, reading the daily lessons each week. And this year we're working with the Way of Mastery. And the Way of Mastery fits so nicely with Guy Finley's work and Michael Rice's work and Diedrich Wolzak's work and Byron Katie's work, that when we were in the support group last night, we were listening to a talk from Guy Finley, and it felt like it was a complete setup, because just the discussion we were having before we put on the video of his talk was so in line with even the special reading that he does. He does a special writing for the beginning of each talk, and it was like he took something verbatim that we'd been talking about and put it in his special thoughts for the talk. And the essence of it is that unattended thoughts bring unwanted relationships. So the core of this work, the Way of Mastery, as a book says, right in the very first lesson, nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice, your choice of where you focus your mind energy. So if you're paying attention to this creative force that is in you and always on, whatever you point your thoughts toward, you're going to create more of, or that thing, the way Guy Finley says it, whatever you focus your attention on teaches you about it. You learn from things by attending to them and questioning. Life will teach you if you will stay in the questioning state. Whatever you turn your focus of your attention upon, you get more of it and or you learn more about it. If you're in the questioning state, if you're in the I know what I know state, then you leave a situation knowing what you knew. But if you stay in the open questioning state and you pay attention to what you're doing with the flow of your thoughts, then you can be consciously creating. But what most of us do is we're raised in a culture that has us believe that our upsets and our emotions and our thoughts are determined by the life events around us and the people around us. And so we quit paying attention to what we are choosing, and we put on the filter that says, I'm a victim here. This is being done to me. This person said this thing about me and it made me angry. This person stood me up for a meeting and it made me feel abandoned or rejected. This person keeps criticizing what I'm doing and it makes me feel like I'm not good enough. The fact of the matter is, if I have thoughts come up in me that I'm not good enough, it's an old tape playing, it's a lie, and if I act from it, I'm going to make my life worse. So everything about the Way of Mastery as a set of tools is designed to help us wake up, to pay attention to what we are doing with this power that we've been given, the power of creation that lies in the very nature of our thought. And last night, We lined up a talk by Guy Finley, and the first thing in his writing was unattended thoughts. If you don't pay attention to what you're doing with your thoughts, they're going to bring you unwanted relationships, unwanted interactions with the world. It is going to be disastrous for you because you're creating blindly. You're creating unconsciously. So, choice. You have a choice. We started reviewing yesterday Lesson 15 from the Way of Mastery. Just because I think it's worth reading these things at least twice, if not many more times than that. And we finished reading it last week, and so we started again, or earlier this week, so we started to review it. Well, here's the very title of Lesson 15. Love or fear, the choice is yours. But if I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing with my thoughts, they're still creating, and I'm creating blindly, or I'm creating unconsciously. And so, I'm here to say we've got a whole set of tools that if we choose to pick them up and use them, can help us develop a level of awareness and vigilance so that we don't leave our thoughts unattended. The Guy Finley quote from his, you know, writing before the talk from, this is a talk from Sunday, July 3rd. And again, all of Guy Finley's talks like this are available absolutely free, which is why I'm completely comfortable sharing them here and referring to them. If you go to guyfinley.org/channel, C-H-A-N-N-E-L, you can get access to his Sunday talks, his Wednesday talks, his students who do Friday talks, special events that have happened. Ever since the coronavirus restrictions went into play, he's been making these available free. He used to charge for them. Not a lot, but, you know, he had very reasonable fees. But now, because of the coronavirus, he just opened it up and put these out there. So this is a replay of a talk from Sunday, July 3rd. Anybody can go there, guyfinley.org/channel. And all you have to do to get access to it is provide a valid email address. But the writing from the talk we listened to from Sunday, July 3rd, begins with the key lesson, part one, unattended thoughts attract unwanted relationships. If we are not paying attention to what we are doing with our thought, with our mind energy, as Michael Rice would call it, we will be attracting unwanted situations and relationships. We will be creating things we prefer not to have. And it's okay. You know, it's like the Bill Hicks story of life is like a ride in an amusement park. It's okay because it's just a ride. You don't need to get all bent out of shape about how you've wasted time. This was another topic in the discussion last night. One of the lessons that we read, I think it's the 14th lesson in this book, or just the previous lesson, the title of it is The Wise Use of Time. And one of our group members was talking about how they've got this tape running in their heads that says they're wasting time, or they wasted time, or they've ruined things because they're not doing it right, etc. And if I let those thoughts run in my mind unattended, if I don't see them as false, if I don't withdraw my attention from them, if I don't change the value that I give them, then they keep running and building momentum and building emotional clout in my system, and I end up beating myself up. But this with work, the Way of Mastery and the Course in Miracles itself, they're very clear about how you've never been made wrong by anybody that counts, by your creator or any universal force outside of you. You're just here in the body, in life, under instruction. You're growing and learning, and quote's been attributed to a number of people. Maya Angelou is one of them, who says, listen, you do the best you can with what you know, and then when you know better, you do better. And there isn't any reason to beat yourself up for not having done better earlier, because everybody's doing the best they can in each new present moment with whatever resources they have in that moment. And that may or may not be true, but I can guarantee you this, because I've been watching it for myself. The more I pretend that's true, the better my life gets. And if I pretend that these people outside of me who are standing me up for a meeting or cutting me off in traffic or throwing swear words and curse words at me or blaming me for all the problems in their life, if I put on the filter as I look to them, and the filter I put on is, everybody's doing the best they can in each new present moment with whatever resources they have in that moment, my life gets better and better. And eventually, one day I wake up and realize, oh, wait a minute, I am also one of those people who's always done the best he or she could with whatever resources they had in the moment. And that awareness, that realization, that shift in perspective wipes out all of the beating of myself up. Wipes out all the self-loathing. And that's a wonderful place to be. So where we left off yesterday was right before the section titled A Meditation to Attune to the Will and Love of the Creator. And the text reads, in this lesson, we wish to introduce a methodology for you for what you might call meditation. It is a form of communion or meditation that was initially and essentially taught by me to several of my friends, what you know of as disciples, one of which carried this specific form of teaching and preserved it. Now, it did not originate with me. I merely refined it. For, just like you, I was once a student of the ways of seeking God. I dove deep into the nature of consciousness and mind itself. And I discovered how to attune the mind, attune the emotions, and even the nervous system of the body to resonate with the perfect will and love of the Creator. To begin to prepare a place for that teaching, for the next 30 days, return to the practice of abiding as Christ for at least 5 minutes. And then, as that 5-minute practice period is completed, allow your eyes to close. Become aware of the simple movement of your own breathing and simply hold the thought, quote, I allow this breath to move more deeply and slowly, close quotes. Then, as you're beginning to feel the sense of relaxation ever more deeply, hold this thought, quote, as Christ, in perfect safety, I release all tension. As Christ, in perfect safety, I dissolve my mind in the perfect peace of the Creator. And then, merely continue in this manner. As the breathing comes to fill the body, gently and merely say, I accept. And as the breath leaves the body on exhale, gently say within the mind, the love of God. And again, as the breath enters the body, I accept. And as it leaves the body, the love of God. Continue in this manner for about 5 minutes, regardless of what the egoic mind says to you, and it will kick up quite a storm, but simply return to this practice. Breathe and soften, and on the inhale, say, I accept. And on the exhale, the love of God. And on the inhale, I accept. And on the exhale, the love of God. At the end of about 5 minutes, let the prayer that you've been offering change from words to energy. You might perceive it as a golden white light. You might feel it as a gentle flow of relaxation. Whatever works for you is just fine. Continue gently to breathe that quality or color into yourself with each breath. And with each letting go of the breath, imagine and feel that energy moving throughout the course of the body as though it were extending like a gentle breeze beyond the boundaries of the body. Again, if the egoic consciousness kicks up its heels, and you start thinking of all the multitude of things that you ought to be doing instead of this exercise, realize it and simply, gently return to the prayer. For all prayer is nothing more than a choice to be made to contemplate and to rest in communion beyond egoic thought. After about another 5 minutes, then say within the mind, as Christ, I have celebrated in this manner the truth of who I am, and I bring peace to the world this day. Then allow this practice period to occur during the morning of your day and then again in the evening of your day. The only change would be that in the final phrasing for the evening, you'll say simply, this day I have brought peace to the world and I have offered it to my companions. That should be clear enough and simple enough for you to begin. Initially, you may wish to refer back to the words of this meditation to use it as a guide for a period of time. But eventually it will seem more comfortable for you to do it on your own. Choose your own words, your own pacing, your own images, your own colors, your own sensations. The text says, those who embark on this simple process will be well prepared for what is to come in the lessons that follow. Would you like to till the soil? Would you like to be able to be receptive? Would you like to be able to be consciously creating your tomorrows with the choice of energy that you focus your mind on today? If so, the Way of Mastery and these exercises are providing wonderful tools to move you toward that experience. So, our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and we've got a little over half an hour to entertain comments or questions or reactions, to hear about people's experience with these exercises. I think I mentioned that beyond this 15th lesson, moving into the 16th lesson, it changes, for me, it changes direction quite a bit. And I still haven't decided how I will present that, if and when I will present that. But it's really more of an intellectual exercise that's a different way of tilling the soil. It's a different way of helping people question what they've been trained to believe. There's a quote in that 16th lesson near the end of it where in the section on ending all seeking, how do you end your seeking? You choose to live as though you are not your ego. You choose to live as though you are unlimited spirit, as lesson 13 would tell us. And there's a quote in that 16th lesson that says, only love is real. You are not the body. I and my Creator are one. I am awake, and I walk this planet as Christ. I choose love over fear. What does that mean? It means love is pure spirit. I choose to recognize my connection to all things. I choose to recognize I am not limited by the body. I choose to recognize this Christ consciousness that each and every one of us can tap into. I choose to work to develop an awareness of this internal alarm system I've been given, which is my emotional energy system. And if I choose those things, the results will occur. The end is certain, as they've told us several times already in the first 15 lessons. And it's okay if I don't choose that, if I choose something else. You're free to choose. That's the message over and over and over again. You are free to choose. The choice is always yours. And of course, when we say that, the egoic mind starts kicking up all kinds of complaints and arguments and reasons why that shouldn't be so, that can't be so, events aren't neutral, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And again, this work would tell us the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. So your intellect can argue against all of these things, can give you reasons and rationalizations to be angry and mean and bitter and hurtful and judgmental and know you're right and the other person's wrong. Your intellect can do that because your intellect has been shoved full of all of these trivialities and judgments and templates for critical analysis, etc. And your intellect has been shoved full of thoughts that you know you're right and the world is wrong, despite the fact that you're not even able to be aware of a tiny fraction of 1% of what hits your senses. And your senses only record a tiny fraction of 1% of what's actually happening in the world. So hopefully you can introduce to yourself the observation that it is ludicrous to say, I know. Especially when I think I know, I'm filled with any kind of a negative emotional response. There's a built-in guidance system, like a compass or a Geiger counter, that's there to alert us when the focus of our mind energy is off the mark, is unproductive, is detrimental. It's actually mind-boggling to me to sit back and realize how directly contradictory to actuality our life training is in our families and in our culture. It's mind-boggling to me that we still don't teach children in schools the same kinds of things we're discussing here. What Julie Haverstick was doing in her classroom was far more useful than teaching people reading, writing, and arithmetic. Teaching people their true nature, teaching people that they are the authors of their emotional states, that they have the power to choose, that they are creative beings, they have dominion over their mind energy, which is a creative force. All of those things are infinitely more important and valuable in our lives, practically speaking, than the reading, writing, and arithmetic, geography, etc., that most of us were programmed with in school. So again, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Give us a call. Press 1. Let's have a conversation. What's on your mind? How might we be of service heading into this weekend? What's resonating with you or not so much resonating with you as we read, again, through Lesson 15? I think I'm fairly well caught up on the files for the MindShiftersAcademy.org website, where there's these shows, the first hour of these shows since January 10th, have been edited out and put on a separate page there. I think I'm caught up to yesterday's show. And, as always, if you've got a comment or a question about a show where you think, you know, this show was one that I don't want to have to keep searching for, I want it on the highlights page for the Way of Mastery with Commentary, let me know. Either call and press 1 or send me an email at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And it's relatively easy for me to take one of those and move it over to the highlights page. I had somebody I was working with earlier today, and they're struggling mightily with trusting themselves. And whenever that happens and you're having somebody who is decidedly above average intelligence and has demonstrated competency in a variety of areas, it's going to be an emotional issue. It's going to be an unconscious emotional dynamic that they're going to need to see all the way to the roots in order to be free of it. So anytime you have a thought in your mind that says, I would really like to accomplish A, B, and C, and they would happen in this sequence where first I have to do A, and then I do B, and then I do C, and I'm going to be really happy when I finish accomplishing project labeled C. And you're at it for days or weeks or months or years, and you still haven't either finished A and moved on to B, or finished B and moved on to C. Or you got A and B done and you won't start C. Or you're right at the edge and you could finish C, but you just don't do it. Like being what they call in the graduate programs, all but dissertation. You do all the coursework, you do all the practicums, you do the internship, you pay all the money, you take all the classes, you get all the decent grades, you pass all the tests. And all you have to do to be called doctor or whatever, or the master's level, is you have to finish your thesis or your dissertation. And something This is a very well-known dynamic. Something prevents people from accomplishing those last few steps. Well, whether it's in the pursuit of an advanced degree academically or anything else in your life, if that's happening, if you're experiencing that, it's because there's a set of reasons within you, dynamics within you, that are making it important for you to procrastinate or to simply stop dead in your tracks. And if you'd like to know what that is, you need to ask. You need but ask. But you need to ask with the filter on that Way of Mastery is presenting to us, and Michael Rice presents to us, and Guy Finley presents to us. And that filter is, I'm the one creating this. If I ask with the filter of who's doing this to me, I can be asking for centuries and I'll never have an answer. Or I'll have a whole series of answers, but no progress will ever be made. But if I ask through the filter of how am I doing this? How am I making it important to me to not finish this, make progress in this, move from A to B to C? If I'm willing to ask that question, if I'm willing to practice some of these exercises, I will start to see what's in me that's blocking me from accomplishing what I say I want to accomplish. And when I do, when I see it for what it is, one of two things will happen. Either I will realize what kind of a need I'm trying to satisfy by preventing myself from accomplishing the task, and I'll see a different way to satisfy that need without blocking myself from accomplishing the task. And in a heartbeat, in a breeze, with a flip of the hand, I'll do the task and be done with it. Or I'll recognize at one level or another that these series of tasks that I've lined up to do A and then B and then C, they aren't really in my best interest. And my procrastination or my delay is a self-protective thing. And I'll realize I don't really want to do A, B, and C. I don't really want to accomplish this degree or work in the job I would have to work in after I got that doctorate or whatever. And I'm going to be moving through that situation in peace, in comfort, in satisfaction that I probably haven't experienced in years. Once I see the actual dynamics in me that have been driving my thoughts, emotions, and behaviors. There's a line from the Course in Miracles that says, we need only return to the original error in thought and see it for what it is in order for all the negative effects of that error in thought to be dismantled. And if you think about that statement, if you think about the power in that statement, boy, if that's true, that is amazingly powerful. And yet, I see it time and again in therapy. I have heard this from a variety of different, what I would call deep, true spiritual practices. Krishnamurti, probably the first one that I read him saying over and over again, when you see clearly what has you stuck, you're no longer stuck. When you see clearly the dynamic or mechanism that's causing your upset, there'll be no more upset. And this is why we've said so often in this work, when somebody comes to me and they've got, you know, steam coming out of their ears and their voice is elevated and they're using angry words and they're saying, I know why I'm angry. I know instantly they have no clue what's generating their anger. If they're still angry, they don't know what's causing their anger. They've got targets to blame. They're practicing the blame game very, very well. But the way the human mind-body energy system works, the spiritual experience we're having, the way it works is when you see clearly, you're not in upset. When you're in the present moment, you're not engulfed by the negative emotions. You're not blinded by the bitterness and hatred and anger and resentment and hurt and confusion and overwhelm. I think it's Richard Moss who has the mandala that he places on the floor and invites people to step into these various positions and explore the thoughts and emotions and energies that they inhabit and that inhabit them when they are thinking about somebody else is causing this, or I'm causing this, or this is about the past, or this is because I'm worried about the future. And in each of those positions and thought patterns, I generate very different experiences of life, and then eventually has the person step into the middle of the mandala, which is the center representing now, centered in time in this moment, and breathe and question and explore what's the truth about what's getting generated right now. And in that moment, when people do that exercise, they realize there is no fear being generated, there is no anger, no hurt, no resentment being generated. When I'm fully present in the moment, when I see the truth of what's generating my upset is dismantled instantaneously. To whatever degree I'm able to stay in the present moment, my mental, emotional life gets better by leaps and bounds. And if you've got any questions or comments about that or anything we've read earlier today or anything that's come up in the 11-plus years of this work and the radio show, give us a call, 563-999-3581. I'm clicking on the microphone for, I think it's Susan.
It is. Hi, Dr. Tim.
Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, this is very interesting, and something came to mind as you were just talking, and I haven't even wanted to approach this because I don't know what I want at the end of it. I have conflicting goals, I guess. The thing is, my identity when I was a child, I was good at playing the piano, so I became the pianist to myself. That was my ego. I became the pianist. I wasn't really myself, and I did it for a lot of reasons that had nothing to do with loving music. I made myself practice the piano I started the lessons at age 9. My mother made a deal with me, you either practice an hour a day without being told to practice or the lessons go away. So I practiced an hour a day. By the time I was 11, I was practicing 2 or 3 hours a day and getting a lot of praise and attention for my playing. And then I won a competition when I was 12. And that, it became so much of my identity that I didn't realize how much I really didn't like practicing all that much and didn't always like the pieces I was playing and found fault with composers, even Mozart. I remember complaining to my mother that he should have modulated to this key rather than that key or whatever. And she said, "You're arguing with Mozart?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I think he could have done better." So, of course, all the arrogance of that, and all the way through high school, all the way through college, I got passes to go to the orchestra room to practice the piano instead of having a conventional study hall. I'd get up at 5 in the morning at college and make sure I had 2 hours under my belt of practicing before I got out of the music room and could go for breakfast. And then I went to graduate school to get a Doctor of Musical Arts. And I got married and got pregnant with my first daughter and gave my last recital when I was about 9 months along with her. Somebody had gotten sick in a concert series, and I was called to say, can you fill in? And I had a recital already because I'd just given a graduate recital at school. So I played that, and a thought came to me. I cannot put my baby through the tension that I feel when I'm getting ready for a concert. And when she was born, I quit, kind of cold turkey, and went into a depression, went into therapy, was amazed at what I learned in therapy, although here I am asking questions even now, decided to go back to school and become a counselor, got a master's degree and started a little private practice, and I loved doing that, but I missed the music. But I could not go back. I developed nearly a PTSD-type phobia for going to the piano. And it has been, and then somebody came by who was a friend who was getting his degree at Yale Music School, and he said, I need an accompanist. Could you accompany my graduate recital? And I said, sure, that wouldn't be bad because I don't have to practice that much. I don't have to memorize the music. I loved doing that, but still I became, and he said, can you set a psalm? I've told some of this on the show before. Can you set a psalm to music and that I've always liked? And then you'll have, if you set it, then you'll have to come to my church, which was an Episcopal church downtown, and be the pianist while I sing it. And I did that, and that was the beginning of my husband and my returning from studying Eastern religions and coming back to the church. So there was a wonderful thing that happened there. Long story, I'll shorten it up and just say, even now, I could probably play as much as I thought I wanted to or whatever, but I have this weird relationship with going to the piano and practicing. I check to see my fingers are good, and I have a few pieces that I can play for a prelude or a postlude at church if the organist gets sick. But basically, I'm no longer playing the piano, and I don't feel very good about that. And I wonder why my tolerance, I can play 15, 20 minutes, and then I say, that's enough. I get up and leave. And I haven't even wanted to look at that because I don't know whether I want to be able to go back to the piano for hours and hours or quit totally. I don't know which. So anyway, I'm just throwing out all this stuff and thinking, how can I apply these tools to find something out that I haven't found out before? And I'll stop talking right then and see if you have anything to say or a direction to point in.
Well, what's the goal of finding something out? What's the pain point or stuck point? Is it that part of you wants to keep playing longer than 15 or 20 minutes and another part of you keeps shutting it down? Or is it that you're actually perfectly fine just practicing or playing for 15 or 20 minutes and then walking away, but there's some part of your mind that says you should be doing more?
That's it. Right there. I should be doing more.
And what's behind the should? Is there some kind of a thought about how I was given this talent and so I need to develop it to its maximum, or I need to present it to others? What's the should?
Good question. I don't know, and I've wondered about that. I have conflicting thoughts, like here I am, 78 years old. What am I expecting to do with this? My fingers will be non-operative quite soon, within a month or 15 years. In any case, these fingers will not be useful at all. I won't have a brain. I won't have a body. I won't be able to play. I won't be able to do anything. I won't even be breathing. So what's the big deal? I ask myself that, but I don't get any answers.
Well, so, you know, there's a set of questions around do you, as this kind of person or that kind of person or somebody who did this or that in the past, do you deserve to be happy, to be content, to have joy in your life? Do you have value? Well, this is not one for you to answer right now, but for this is the kind of thing for you to sit with and to maybe journal about or do worksheets on. The idea is, do you have value just because you live and breathe, or does your value derive from what you can do for others? Right? Is your value only measured by how much joy you bring to people by playing the piano for them, or how many meals you cook, or how much money you give this person or that person? So there's a set of questions around, you know, digging in a little bit to trying to figure out, okay, what's behind this should that says I should play the piano more? And maybe it's at a core level not feeling worthy or valuable or loved and lovable. And maybe it's something about this exchange for, you know, my value comes strictly from this kind of a zero-sum game trade-off. I have to do this and earn that, and I have to give this to people to have value. And so that's a level of exploration you can do with either targeted journaling or, you know, direct questioning. So sometimes we download a belief like, you know, I did this horrible thing to my little sister when I was 7 years old, and, you know, I made fun of her in front of her friends and I made her cry. And so I am such a horrible person. I remember that. And every time I remember that memory, I cringe and I have shame around it. And I believe at my core, and it may never come to the conscious level, but I might be holding a belief that says, because I was so horrible to my little sister, I don't deserve to be happy. I don't deserve to have success, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that can literally be sitting in me and driving my perception and my choices and my behaviors. It can keep me stuck. And if that's in there, I need to discover it. I need to get clear about it. I need to be able to see the ridiculousness of it from the adult perspective. It didn't seem ridiculous at all when I was 7 and I started to have remorse for what I had done to my sister, and I downloaded this belief that said, I should be punished for this. I don't deserve to be happy. But from an adult perspective, I can look back and realize, my gosh, 7-year-olds, they're very immature. They know very little about, you know, themselves and relationships and long-term effects. And this particular 7-year-old who was making fun of his sister was probably in his own tortured conflict at the time. So I have compassion for that 7-year-old, and I dismantle the belief that because of the quality or nature of that 7-year-old, I, as an adult, don't deserve to have success or joy or contentment in my life. So what's driving your should, right? So all of the different ways that you might question for yourself, what's behind the I should play the piano more? You know, do I have some kind of a belief about some cosmic system that needs me to be playing the piano in order for the cosmic system to be balanced?
Yeah.
Or do I have some belief about karma that says, you know, if I waste the talents that I was given at birth, then I'm going to have to come back life after life trying to make up for that mistake?
You know,
these are the kinds of
there are so many
you can
things
explore.
In
you. Yeah, you can explore those. And you can open up to the idea that none of them are true in an absolute sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they only have the value that you give them. What were you going to say?
I remember when I was really very conflicted about this when my daughter was first born, and I had a singer friend of mine come over. And she said to me something about how she loves to cook. And she put the kind of value on her cooking that I had put on my piano playing. And she said, do you think people will like me if I don't cook well? And I thought that was the most ridiculous idea. Who cares if you cook well or not? It has nothing to do with your value. And I remember thinking that went so deep, and I thought, this applies to me and my piano playing. But I never really looked at it. And my sense of value, if somebody asked me what's the most important thing for a person to do in life or be, I would say along Michael Rice lines, be a human being, be loving, be love, give everyone the active present, conscious, active present love. That's the important thing. None of the other stuff really matters, and no one cares about anything but that. They don't want really to get anything except that. That's when people feel really good. It's when they're in the presence of someone who is Christ-like, and your readings are stirring up all this. But I've got this clinker in there of just the piano is still hanging on around the edges. I did quit for months. And then my church needed something. I said, oh, yeah, well, I'll brush up some old things that I used to play. And I was pleasantly surprised that my fingers are perfectly good. And the pieces came back into my fingers pretty fast. And then I thought I should keep doing this. Well, the fact is I had no problem during those months of not playing, except that I kept apologizing to the piano as if the piano had feelings. I'd say, I'm sorry, I'm not playing you. I know you'd like to be playing. I anthropomorphize the piano even. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it makes no sense to go into all this right now. You've given me an invitation to really look at this, and I don't really want to do it, but I think I better do it. It might be a good idea.
Well, some part of you wants to do it, or you wouldn't have called and raised the question. So
I know, that's true. So I'm very, changing the subject, I'm very curious about the different kind of chapter that the next chapters are, and you seem to have a distaste for them in some way.
Distaste so much as I'm looking at the show, the internet show, and its continuity and what might be useful. And
yeah.
So, you know, the way that I went through this book, I spent probably more than a year just on the first 12 lessons, maybe
uh-huh.
2 years just on the first 12 lessons without ever reading into the second book.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, having that foundation, understanding that that's the core, that the way of the heart, choosing the way of the heart and the awakened heart and loving energy and over the intellect and all of the ego and rationalizations, that is far more important than anything that's left to come. As a matter of fact, in Lesson 6, it says right there in the intro, it says, indeed, greetings, beloved and holy friends. And then it stops and spends two or three paragraphs saying, listen, if you understood those words right there, you wouldn't need the rest of this book.
Right.
So from that perspective, when we get into Lesson 16 and 17 and 18, where it starts talking about the birth of egoic consciousness and did you have existence before you came into the body and you know, how did we create the dream of separation and all of that, it's more of at an intellectual level. And I'm,
mm-hmm.
you know, part of me isn't, I'm not yet convinced that we're ready for that. But I get so little feedback from, you know, people on the call that I don't know. Maybe everybody is ready. Maybe I'm the one holding this back.
Well, no, or
know.
Maybe it's just not, maybe it's, as you just said, if you understand these words, you don't need anything else, and then you're going to take us, and you're constantly trying to convince us not to try to figure things out. And this section of the book sounds like a figuring it out section.
Well, it's more of that giving the conscious logical mind something to chew on so something deeper can take over. It's like a koan at one level. Well,
maybe we
thank
should
you
take
for all the comments and questions, but I am completely out of time, and Michael's probably trying to call in. So what was your suggestion? Maybe we what?
Just start and see how what happens.
Well, we'll get there Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
All right. Blessings.
Great. Have a good weekend.
You too. And I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I hope you have a good weekend.
Same to you. Blessings.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is Friday, July the 8th, 2022. And I am actually going to play a recording from the book club where Michael walked a young lady through doing a worksheet. And this is from June 9th. Hope you enjoy it. Michael's on an airplane right now, so I hope you enjoy this. Thanks.
Do you want to give us a brief outline of what your worksheet's about, just so we've got an understanding of where we're going?
I'm doing a sort of daily lesson course at the moment, and I think today's one talked about that if you keep yourself invisible, then no one can see your needs. And if you unless you're seen, you know, no, you can't tell people your needs and so on. So I realise that's a theme for me, that I keep myself invisible. And I just would like to sort of work on that, really, because it's been a theme for a very long time.
Okay.
And I would like to step into the light. Obviously, I'm scared, but I would like to be seen so that I can communicate, just my talents genuinely share things.
Right. So is there anybody in your life in particular that this plays out with, that we could do a specific worksheet? Is there a person?
Interesting.
It might be a boss, might be a lover.
Yeah,
I
think it could be in every aspect of life, but probably it's probably more difficult in a working thing. Well, no, it'll be in a personal relationship as well. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think I've gone invisible again.
Okay. Well, we're here to support you being fully, completely visible.
Okay. I think I hide from myself as well.
Yeah. And notice that we're a safe space for you to do that. And one of the reasons we hide is because usually we have a stored experience of it not being safe.
Yes.
And that's what you want to access and forgive.
Right. I do know the experience.
Tell me more about that. What does that mean for you?
At primary school, I got sent out of the class every day for about 2 years. And I just used to hide in the coats. And because if you were seen outside of the classroom having been sent out, then if a head teacher or somebody walked past, then you got really rollicked. It was not nice, so you just hid. I'll just do that, really. That's a bit of a theme for me.
Sounds like a good worksheet. So it sounds like then the core of this issue is the desire for safety.
Yes, that sounds reasonable.
Want to be safe. Okay. So you put your name in number 1A. And acknowledge yourself as love. So I, who am love, am feeling. Okay. So what are the feelings that come with this? Here I am hiding among the coats. And if I'm seen, I'm going to be...
Well, probably I've told off, really. Judged.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the feeling on that?
Very much scared, ashamed, really, shame.
Okay. So if there's fear and there's shame, that would be two different worksheets.
Yes.
And so seeing as how fear came first, let's start with the fear one. And I'll suggest that you plan to do, after we complete this, do another worksheet on exactly the same situation
okay.
and do that on shame.
Okay.
That will be a whole different, you know, in order for the mind, when you think of how amazing it is that this mind is so powerful, you know, I'm sitting in a room right now where my brain shows me a clock sitting over there. It shows me a light. It shows me a television set up in the corner. It shows me a computer. And like, it's really got me, like, I could easily believe that I'm seeing all those things out there, as opposed to there's enough data about those things firing in me that I recognize my mind is generating literally that whole world that I see. In order for that to happen, there's a huge amount of data going on under the surface to produce that.
Mm.
And so what we're going to do is thread by thread, and the data is based in thought. The data is based in mind energy. It's interesting. If you go to the opening words in the book of John, and we'll talk about the ancient scriptures here, and they're presented to us as something religious. My background's in electronics, a side study in physics. And as a physician, when I first came in touch with the Aramaic translations of these words, what struck me is this has got anything to do with theology. This is just how the mind works. This is how physiology works. This is how energy systems work. This is about physics and physiology and psychology and genetics. So getting to the reality of it. So if you listen to the opening words in the book of John that the churchianity folks told us says, in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh, you go, what does that even mean? If you go to the Aramaic, what it says is in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh. Literally, when I think of thought, what the cell biologists are now showing us, when I think of thought, that thought becomes a molecule inside of my energy field. That molecule circulates around in my structure until it finds a receptor site with a cell that matches. When it lands on that cell, it inserts itself inside of the cell energetically. And if we were looking from inside the cell, what we would see when that neuropeptide lands on the receptor site and inserts itself, what we'd see coming into the cell would be what we call chemistry. Now, it's all energy, but this is mind energy literally showing up on what we call a physiological level as chemistry. And so not only is it becoming what we call the chemistry in our structure, but it's becoming the construct. It turns it into the constructs that we see. So what we're going to do thread by thread is learn to develop the skill of being able to access that neuropeptide that perhaps has been there for 10 generations or perhaps happened to me when I was 7 and in the cloakroom. Or I stepped out for the first time and somebody raged at me or whatever. What we're looking to do is to be able to access that mind energy, be able to decode it and throw it away. So that literally that chemistry of fear that's in the cell has been removed. That's forgiveness. And so each emotion is reflective of a different thread in the perceptual constructs that we have. So we're going to just pick one at a time. In this case, we're going to use the fear thread.
Okay.
And so that would be the thought. So now I'm going to remember to do that next, that other emotion or any other emotion, a separate worksheet.
Okay.
And then we'll just step into hostility and fear are from internal corrupt data. So when my mind is generating a perceptual construct that is accurate about what's happening in the actual world, you know, that Harvard research I talked about, 10,000 brain cells are firing, 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity happening in the brain, 9 bits of data go into perception. It's been estimated in that same time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, there are perhaps as many as 20 trillion bits of data in the actual world. So there's actuality, what's actually going on, and then there's my perceptual construct, my reality. And whenever the mind is using any form of hostility or fear, that means that my construct, the world that I'm seeing, is built out of data that's been corrupted.
Yes.
Now, if you're working on your computer and all of a sudden you're doing a calculation or whatever, and you get a warning, corrupt data, what just happened? Nothing your computer is telling you is going to be reliable. I'd offer that when hostility or fear is moving, nothing your mind is telling you is going to be reliable, and you want to collapse that. Now,
yes.
We live in a culture that says, a little rage, a little fear never hurt anybody. Well, my offering is it's the only thing that could ever possibly kill us, and it's time for us to clean it up. So here's how you clean it up.
Okay.
So hostility and fear, if you're following along the worksheet, now we're down below step 1B, are from internal corrupt data and indicate my use of sustained incoherence to build this disturbing internal construct. So here I've got this construct in my mind that's painful to me. There's a physicist named David Bohm who coined this term sustained incoherence. David Bohm was a cohort of Einstein's. He actually worked in Einstein's laboratory. He actually worked on doing some of the math with which they developed the atomic bomb. He was a genius in many realms, and he also worked in the realm of psychological research. And in essence, here's David Bohm's definition of sustained incoherence. I deny that the thoughts that are corrupt in me are producing my pain. I've built a picture in my mind that my pain's caused by somebody else. I refuse to own that my pain is caused by my own thinking. So I'm going to keep thinking that way, all the while blaming everybody else. That's David Bohm's basic definition of sustained incoherence. And most of the world's living in sustained incoherence. Whenever you rely on your mind's hostility or fear constructs, you're in sustained incoherence. And it's nuts to live there. But, most of the world is nuts. I mean, just take a look at what's going on. How crazy can it get? It's time for us to individually and collectively clean it up.
Mm.
So my denial causes my CBM. What is CBM?
If you were to ask memory.
Carbon-based memory. Okay, you got that one. But for everybody else who's listening, carbon-based memory, if you asked a modern-day physicist to check out your body and tell you what it's made of, the base element in your structure is carbon. And that's where memory is stored. And there's no energy that passes through this energy system that isn't stored in this carbon-based memory system. Okay?
Yeah.
So here we are stuck in a construct out of carbon-based memory, and that goes against us living out of our true nature as love. The truth about each of us, if you hold a newborn child and tap into their essence, the essence of human life is love. But if we've been loaded with all of this sustained incoherence and this generational insanity, we don't think of ourselves as love, and they sure didn't give us messages when they told us to go to the coat room that we were love. Or when we stepped out that, we were given insane ideas. And so what needs to happen is we each need to face that world of sustained incoherence in us and begin to clean it up. And that means cleaning up carbon-based memory, literally cleaning up on an atomic level the energetic patterns that are stored within the structure. And when I live in denial, and in this work, there's a very specific definition of denial. And denial is that either thinking or speaking as though something outside of me is the cause of what's moving inside of me. So when I say mad is moving inside of me, Bill made me mad. I'm now living in denial. I'm telling my mind it's not allowed to show me the truth that this is my mad, because if I own it, I could throw it away. But if it's Bill's and caused by Bill, of course I can't. Yeah. So my denial causes my carbon-based memory to displace my experience of myself as my essence, love, and tells me the lie that this emotion, my emotions are caused by my trigger.
Yeah.
Now you notice that word trigger is underlined and in bold and in italics. Must be something important about it. most everybody calls the triggers in their lives the cause. And so they live in a totally false construct driven by the goals based on believing that cause is out there. What we're looking to do is to step in here to clean that up, which is inside of us. So that denial blocks my awareness of myself as love and tells me the lie that my emotions are caused by somebody else. So now I'm going to look at what the story is I'm telling myself based in the first parts of number one. So my story, my reality is that your object of attention would be the teachers or a specific teacher involved?
I think it sort of became everything. I think in the end I took it on board and I did it for them. You know.
But we don't, now we're switching issues. Switching out of, there's a specific emotion that I'm feeling. I've been hiding out in the cloakroom and I've got this fear. And who am I telling a story about? Who's the object of attention? If I move from this specific to a general, it was kind of like, like this and this and this.
Mm.
I just shifted out of the piece of work that I'm heading toward. So I want to stay on track with this specific situation. So is there a specific teacher that was involved in the scenario?
Yeah, there was, yeah.
Okay, let's put her name or his name in.
His name's Mr. Bolger.
Okay, so number one C would be Mr. Bolger.
Yes.
And if you were to describe what happened, how would you describe that? So my story, my reality is that Mr. Bolger
found me out
there.
Notice
what's happening with your breath right now.
Yeah, it's difficult to speak. I'm hiding again.
Yeah. Well, what happens is the movement of breath is what moves mind energy in the system. And there's something that I don't want to look at and don't want to deal with. And you'll notice at the end of this sentence, there's a sentence and several other sentences in the worksheet. There's a reminder to breathe. Because when I shut my breath down, that's how I keep that stuff hidden. Literally, that's how I create an unconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
So we want you to breathe. And tell me the story about Mr. Bolger did.
He found me in the corridor, took me into the classroom, and then spoke about it.
So called you up on the carpet, so to speak.
Yeah, in front of everybody, just sort of, liar, whatever, all sorts of accusations. Because I just got sent out for talking or being busy or just not being naughty.
Right. But
anyway, there we go. But it happened every day, get out. Two and a half hours, every day.
Take a big breath. Let your shoulders move on that one. Yeah, let it open. Time for you to stop carrying that load of energy around.
Yeah.
Time for forgiveness here. Okay, so then just jot that in and breathe. And then you'll notice that a little hand points over to the right.
Yeah.
Now, all my life, my mind's been telling me that, he was the problem. But then if I remind myself, if Mr. Folger is the one with the problem, why am I the one with the pain? Now, clearly in that situation, Mr. Folger had a problem. I mean, wasn't a very nice guy. He wasn't a very conscious guy. But today, decades later, I'm carrying around pain. I want to recognize that this is mine and it's about me. It's not about him. He's got his own work to do.
Yes.
Okay. So then let's step into number 1D. The truth is, only my thoughts cause my emotional upset. So here I am in fear. What you want to do here is you want to identify the specific mind energy that you use to create this fear. And so the thought, and again, as with the emotions, you use a separate worksheet for each one, specifically related to the fear that you identified in number 1B, what's the thought that causes this fear in you? When you think this thought, it goes to fear.
Being told off.
Okay, so I'm going to be told off.
Mm.
Told off, embarrassed, centered out.
Mm. Judged.
Judged. Okay. That's probably the word. There's the one with the energy. So I'm going to be judged. And then number 1E, is there a punishment thought toward Mr. Folger? If you went back that first time and you're standing there, what would you, if you'd have had the power, what would you as a young girl have said or done? You know, there are no consequences. You just, you're there. You got permission to do whatever.
I would like to say that's not true. That's not true. Yeah.
Yeah, but with all that fear going on and the way you've been embarrassed, is there something maybe a little more that you might want to do to him? Breathe. Like, I can easily imagine if that were me, that I might even be wanting to kick him in a certain part of the anatomy. Punishment.
Well, I was pretty powerless. It was pretty awful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in that,
he was quite scary. He used to cane children as well. And I watched him do that too to some other child. He was really quite a beast.
Yeah. So, if you'd have been had the power at that time, what would you have done to that beast?
Oh, I'd taken that stick, hit him with a stick.
And you've used it. Okay. So there's your punishment thought.
That feels very good to say that. Sorry.
No, that's you're trying to move the energy. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're acknowledging a part of yourself you've been hiding from yourself, and that always feels good.
Yeah.
So I wanted to punish Mr. Folger by picking that stick up and using it on him.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And then on yourself, was there a punishment thought toward yourself? Notice what's happening with your breath.
I know.
And shut this down.
I know.
So take a breath.
I know. You ask me the questions and I go all blank because I'm hiding again. I'm going invisible.
There's your punishment thought, I suspect, toward yourself, is I have to just be invisible.
Yes.
I'm going to disappear.
Yes.
So that's what I'd put there for your punishment thought toward yourself.
Okay.
And then once again, you'll see that hand points to a little box. And the box, you know, most often the traumas that we hold are instilled in the mind and accompanied by words.
Yes.
So verbal release can be a powerful way, you know, words are representative of mind energy. Verbal release can be a powerful way of starting to cause that energy that's perhaps been held for decades to exit carbon-based memory. So this little box introduces the idea of verbal release. I want to start to tap into the presence of love in me and be in a willingness space to take all of this accumulated energy. And what tends to happen when we have an experience, you know, at the age of 4 is we tend to play that out. We'll see at the end here. We tend to play that out over and over and over and over and over again our whole lives.
Yes.
And the whole idea of this forgiveness process is to put an end to that cycle.
Especially
the self-punishment.
I still do that. I work at a school and I always assume if the head wants to speak to me, I'm going to get told off. I always feel judged by my peers for not being good at my job. You know, it still carries on. And even last night, a friend wanted to chat about their problem, but I thought I was going to get told off. So,
it's developed an expectation, a structure where there's an expectation of being abused.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to suggest you do when we finish this or once the video is available is you go back and you start making notes. There's a worksheet thing that we call a hydra. And if you remember in Greek philosophy, the hydra was the creature that when you cut her head off, a dozen other heads grew out of the stump where you cut the head off. And what you just shared with us is this is a hydra worksheet for you. just shared two or three places where it's shown up in your life. So these would be good worksheets for you to do. So I'd suggest you sit down and rewatch this video. We'll stay focused on this worksheet, but you rewatch this video and go through each time, do a worksheet on what happened with last night with that coworker and how your mind set it up. Do, you know, worksheets on how you've been treated at school as an adult. And they'd each be the Hydra worksheets that help you clear this whole thing up.
Did it? I did write it down on paper, but then
okay.
I couldn't keep up with it all.
So first of all, it's yourself.
Yes. I say.
And use your name. I release and surrender myself. My name. And use your name.
I release and surrender myself, Sarah, to love.
To love. And then the emotion was fear.
And I release and surrender fear to love.
Yeah. And then number one C was Mr. Bolger.
Mr. Bolger, yeah. I release Bolger. And surrender Mr. Bolger to love.
Okay. And I release and surrender the story.
I release and surrender the story to love.
Well, be more specific. You know, repeat what the story was, what you wrote there.
Okay. I release and surrender being collared in the cloakroom and told off. I release that to love.
Yeah, and being brought up in front of the classroom and
humiliated. Yeah, really humiliating.
Yeah. So I release that. Yeah. I'm going to let that humiliation go.
Release and surrender that humiliation.
Because notice that your mind's still playing out that humiliation on yourself, and notice this is another piece of the puzzle. It moves in a different direction. In our codependence work, we introduce a concept of what we call a power person.
Mm.
And three things happen to develop a power person dynamic. And when these three things happen simultaneously, and it's usually a child, and it's oftentimes with an adult or an authority figure, but can also happen in adulthood. But the three things that happen is that one, the person who's we're going to identify as the power person. We're going to talk about instilling a power person dynamic in our minds. The person who's going to be the power person, number one, is not functioning as love, has more power over my life than I do, and I perceive it as survival, physical or psychological survival, maybe even financial survival. They can be the dynamics. So when those three things happen, they got more power than I do, they're not functioning as love, and I perceive it as survival. What happens is, as an energy field, when you realize this body-mind unit's an energy field, the energy field opens wide and it becomes like a sponge. And it literally just sucks in every energy from the environment. Literally every mental energy, every emotional energy, everything that's going on is literally just taken in with no censoring. In the future, that becomes the control of our behavior. And I'd offer that this power person dynamic is what runs the world. And until we confront it, understand it, and work through it in ourselves, it will run virtually every moment of our lives. And here's how it runs it. Once a power person dynamic is instilled, and it sounds like that was a moment for you where that was instilled, there are only three behaviors that we'll do for the rest of our lives. And they'll be based on that power person dynamic. Now, this thing with Mr. Bolger might have been a reflection of something earlier with perhaps a parent. I don't know.
Yes.
But it really doesn't matter. But this is the dynamic. And the behaviors that we'll do will be controlled by the level of stress that we're under. When there's no stress, you know, there's a thing in the mind, we do a course called Laws of Living, and we identify what we call the automatic decision system. When the automatic decision system kicks in and there's no stress, I'll do whatever I did to get along with my power person. When stress starts to build, I'll move out of doing what I did to get along with them, and I'll do what I did to resist and survive with them. When I become ultra stressed, I'll do what my power person did to me that I hated the most. Runs the world. And so I ask you the question, have you ever found yourself when you're under stress, humiliating people?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I turn it outward and do it to other people.
Okay.
I don't know. I'll have to think about that one, because obviously I do have to do classroom management as well, because I work at a school.
Right. So do you ever find yourself using any humiliation tactics to keep control in the classroom? Which means when I feel like I need to be in control is when I'm under stress?
Well, I suppose it's culturally acceptable to be saying, we talk about the children's silly behaviour. Yes, silly behaviour. You know, at first I found that quite offensive when I first started at the school. But because we all identify silly behaviour as silly, I now speak about silly behaviour. But at first I found it quite, because obviously I would have been called silly as well, and stupid and all sorts of words like that. I never called a child stupid, but we do commonly talk about silly behaviour.
Mm-hmm. You'll be the one that changes the norm in that whole system and honors children more, because every behaviour a child does is done in order to accomplish a goal. And when we can support the child and their behaviors that we consider to be silly or abhorrent or unacceptable, the child is doing them for a valid purpose.
Yes.
And when we can validate the child and open the space of safety and bring love present, then they can forgive what's in them. That which is in them can be removed, and they'll step up to the plate and become totally different beings.
Interesting.
Yeah. But it's about creating that space of safety and healing. And most of us don't ever look at these power person dynamics, because when they happened, it wasn't safe to look or deal with it.
I think the behavior I do to other people is to ignore them and zone them out. So I make them invisible if I'm upset with them. I'll avoid them.
Yeah. So notice that in that whole situation, what you did to yourself was become invisible. In that power person dynamic, the thing that you hated the most was what he did that brought you to invisibility. And now you're treating other people as though they're invisible.
Yes. Yes.
As opposed to, you know, what somebody who's in pain really needs is somebody to be there with them.
Yes.
And somebody that's a human being is the active presence of love and is able to interact with them and hold the space that supports them and working through whatever's going on. I mean, that's the thing that's so desperately needed in our culture. And I don't care whether it's, you know, the guy who was just the president of the United States, you know, I wouldn't want to live in that man's body. When I listen to the language, the words, the things that he does, I think of, oh my God, that man is in so much pain. And he doesn't have anywhere where he can open that up and heal. And so he just keeps carrying on the power person dynamic in his life. And that's what virtually everybody's doing. And what we need are people who are empowered enough to be able to be the space and support the cleaning up of this mass insanity that's running our culture. So starting with the kids, a powerful place to do it.
Mm. Okay.
Cool. Sweet. All right, so let's move on to number two.
Oh, okay.
So what I'm going to do now, so I've done that verbal release. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to start to acknowledge that if my mind's lying to me, I'm more interested in the truth than my mind's lie. And so in doing that, I'm ready to embrace everything that's in me, whether it's my own experience or generational patterns. I'm willing to embrace those things and begin to move through it. So number two starts out with an acknowledgement of that.
Mm.
And so I choose to love truth. And actually, you could scratch that word love and change it to honor truth. That's a change we've made in the worksheet. That should really be honor. I choose to honor truth and willingly face and process out all disease-producing energies for or from all of my relations or all of my generations. And I actually kind of took that out of the Native American teachings on healing. And they have a phrase, you know, if a Native American person is going into a sweat lodge or a healing ceremony, they'll stop at the door of the sweat and they'll say Matakwiyasan. And Matakwiyasan means for all of my relations, that I realize I'm not doing this healing process just for me, but as I enter into this sweat, I'm willing to take on the burdens from all of my generations and literally energetically become the space. Right now, there's some processing happening for me. If you were to look, if you can see it on the camera, I don't know if you can, but the hair on my arms and my legs is standing up because for me, this is reaching a whole new level of the recognition of the willingness that I'm willing to, and we can all take on the energetic traumas of our generations and be the space for healing that. Because there's so many generations that went before us that didn't have a clue what to do about it. So with sincerity, I join you in saying that I'm willing to take on these generational patterns.
Yes.
And then number 1B, I'm willing to go through the physical, mental, and emotional symptoms of healing.
Yes.
So when I realize that this energy system has been in development for thousands of generations, when a disintegrative quality of energy came into my structure, it created symptoms. And if I've adapted and shut that down and I have my fifth of scotch so I don't have to look at it and I do my little bit of rage or trauma and I don't have to look at those things, I hide that from myself. Now I'm ready to reverse the flow of energy. Instead of pouring trauma in and trying to keep it shut down, I'm willing to embrace it. I'm willing to let it open and move on every level that it can open and move. And there are basically three levels on which healing happens. And this is one of the reasons why literally our whole Western world has become drugged, because we don't want to deal with what's in here. And the drugs are used to shut those things down. So now I want to open and literally visualize my whole energy field right down to my genes being able to open. And I'm willing to embrace and go through those energies. And on a physical level, healing looks like any kind of physical symptom you've ever had and low energy. On a mental level, looks like any kind of negative thought you've ever had and confusion. On an emotional level, looks like any kind of negative feeling you've ever had and depression. So they're the kinds of things, and that's what I was talking about with the gentleman earlier in his question of stepping, dropping into those things. Am I willing to open my field and embrace and move through those things?
Yes.
And so this is just a request that you acknowledge that and our step into willingness.
Okay. I, Sarah, am willing to go through the physical, mental, and emotional symptoms of healing.
Good. Okay. Now, number 3. So I'm in the space of willingness. Now I want to look at what the key driver is for this pain perception. So my desire, the constructive result, the exact goal that drives my pain perception is that I want number 1C, my trigger 2. So if you were to go back, you're standing there at the front of the room, Mr. Bulger's doing his thing. If you were to be able to just put a halt on that whole scene and say, Mr. Bulger, right now, what I'd really like from you is, what would that be? Go back and be that young child.
To teach me, because I couldn't read. I just got sent out all the time. Yeah.
Okay. So now this is the goal that drives perception. So in essence, what I hear is that what you were looking for was support rather than rejection and criticism.
Yes.
So each time you do a worksheet, you want to look at what's the constructive result. A worksheet won't work with what you don't want. It's like, you know, most people, if they've thought of that, would say, well, Mr. Bulger, I don't ever want you to do this to me again. That won't get you there. It's Mr. Bulger, what I really need, what I really want is for you to teach me and support me in what needs to happen. And think of those kids in school that they say are silly. You know what they're asking for?
Attention.
Support and teaching. Yeah, exactly the same thing. So then write that in number six or number three.
Yes.
Construct a result and make sure you breathe.
Which there's two gaps. Something might trigger something.
So you're in number three. My desire, the constructive result.
Yeah, I didn't read the whole sentence. My desire, the constructive result, the exact goal of the drives of my pained perception, is that Mr. Bolger, my trigger. I'm confused now, sorry.
Okay, so Mr. Bolger is your trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the concern? What did I want from him? I wanted support and caring.
Yeah, support. One time he told me off for having a reading age of 8 when I was thinking, well, just help me. Don't tell me off for it. It's not my
fault.
What
are you here for?
You're the teacher.
Yeah,
help
exactly.
me.
Yeah.
I mean, tell me off for being naughty, but don't tell me off for not being able to read.
Right. So how many times those children that your culture has taught you to think about as silly, that's really what they're asking for. That's really
they're asking for support. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then that would be your answer. That would be the goal.
Yes.
That's the core of this worksheet.
Yes.
Okay. Now, before we step into doing what it takes to can't collapse the pained perception here, what I want to do is tap into and bring forward the presence of active love.
Okay.
If you hold a newborn child and you tap into the essence of that newborn, you'll notice that the newborn is love. And if you ask yourself the question when you're holding the newborn, is the newborn loving me? You have to say, no, the newborn isn't loving me. The newborn is love. That's the essence of that newborn. And then recognize that's the essence of you and I. Mm-hmm. That's what each of us are. That's the truth of us. So I want to bring that essence forward here in number three. So I choose love, my essence, which then stirs the love in everyone involved.
Yes.
If I get lost in my pain and trauma through resonance, literally, you know, there's a camera called the Delaware camera that literally can take a picture of the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. If I'm in my trauma, what tends to happen? You know, if I'm a teacher who's been traumatized as a kid and I stand in front of a classroom and this child's in trauma, I'm in trauma, then I'm going to tend to resonate more of that in the child. And what I want to do is I want to heal those dynamics in myself so that I can stand as a space of active love. And I like to tell a story. You'll see at the end of that sentence, there's the rose and the butterfly. Mm. It's illustrative of the point. Let's imagine that we give the rose and the butterfly an ego. We introduce them, they meet, they fall in love. They have this wonderful time together. And one day the butterfly up and flies away. What happens to the rose when it uproots itself to give chase?
It can die.
It dies. Why does it die?
It
dies
itself.
Because it made something more important than being connected to its source.
Yes, that's nice.
Your source, my source, is love.
Mm-hmm.
If we make anything else more important, then we uproot ourselves from the truth of who we are, and we live in a whole false construct of self. If you go back to the Aramaic language, you hear this man Yeshua saying, in order for you to live, you've got to die. That false self that we've identified with from our disconnected state, uprooted from love, we've created this false self. Oh, I'm strong, I'm powerful, I'm good enough, I'm all these crazy things, and there's no connection to the truth of who we are. So you want to start to tap in more and more and cultivate your relationship with yourself as active love.
Yes.
So the objective of this step three is to bring love present into the process, or step four, pardon me. And then in step five, now we're going to do the action steps. 5A, and basically this is kind of a review of the whole process. When upset, my perception, my mind's construct is built of corrupt data driven by my goal, number three, the goal to be cared for by Mr. Folger. It is a limiting structure constructed from a max of 9 bits of data out of 10,000 brain cells firing. By canceling my goal, my replicate mind, and that's this carbon-based memory system can only replicate what's in it, my replicate mind's reality collapses. So by canceling the goal, my replicate mind's construct collapses and gives me direct contact with the underlying denied and dissociated parts of my carbon-based memory, which projects and blames others for its content. So here's the action step. Back, I'm tapping into the presence of love. The more powerfully love is present, the deeper the internal processing will go. While holding love conscious, active, and present, I now choose to collapse my mind's lies by willingly canceling my goal for Mr. Bolger to teach, support, and hold love for me.
Yes.
And breathe. And notice that you've drawn yourself a whole community of people that are right here holding you in that space and supporting you in this process that you're doing.
Yes.
Nice work. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, thank you.
You must have really been ready for this. That's awesome.
Yes, I think I am. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So I'm canceling that goal.
Yeah.
And then there's a second part to it. When you realize that, you know, this 9-bit construct, underlying it might literally be, I mean, to really develop, you know, a picture my mind constructs of all this world that I think is out there that's really a construct from in here. So mass, maybe trillions of bits of data. And I have what we metaphorically call a 9-bit mind, you know, the 9 bits of data going on here. How long is it going to take me to process through these trillions of bits of data, doing it 9 bits at a time? It's like, good luck, it's never going to happen. Well, 2,000 years ago, Yeshua taught that inside of us, there was an elemental force, an elemental force that was feminine in nature, that if we invited it into activity, in our modern language, we would maybe call it the super processor. So, but literally each one of us inside of us, there's this capacity, there's this elemental force. In Aramaic, it was called Ruach HaKodesh. It's feminine, and by definition, and you'll see the definitions down at the bottom of the page, look at Ruach HaKodesh, she who undoes the effects of my errors and teaches me the truth. So when I'm ready to collapse this construct that I've been holding on to tightly because I think it's survival and I think it's who I am, when I'm ready to let it go and I'm ready to invite this elemental force into activity, what I'll find is there's an energy that starts to move in me that is not of my human nature, that is not something I can even comprehend. But if I'm willing to move, if I'm willing to be with it, it literally will begin to undo these unconscious structures. And if I'm in a space of listening, it will start to instruct me. That's Ruach HaKodesh in Aramaic.
Yeah.
There's a power in us literally that energetically has contact with the whole world. And if we'll let ourselves be in touch with it, it's been called intuition. If we'll let ourselves be in touch with it, it will explain anything and everything to us. So here's the invitation. You're inviting that power to go to work in you in step number 5B.
Yes.
So I invite, and whatever term you would use, the Greek scriptures translated these words, Ruach HaKodesh is the Holy Spirit. Doesn't have anything to do with some disembodied spirit being. It literally is a feminine elemental force inside of us that is never going to violate our free will. We can keep it shut away, or we can invite it into activity, and literally you will begin to be taught things that are so specific, it will boggle your mind.
Yeah.
So this is a space to invite Rukka into activity. And there's a blank there. You'll see the Aramaic, Rukka Dikudsha. Down below, you can see the definition. But I usually, when I do a worksheet, I just short form this. Do I invite Rukka? And there's several things we suggest you invite that elemental force in you to do. One, to incline me toward healing. It's like most people, like, I'm in my drama and trauma, and that's how I win. And don't talk to me about that healing stuff. I need this rage to protect me. Well, I'm shifting that. I want support from underneath to incline my mind toward healing, to restore me to my newborn essence, love. And you'll see a hand points over to Rachma, that when that's restored, there's a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that opens up and literally is the gateway that our created essence, love, enters this human form. So I'm asking for support in being restored to that newborn essence, which is love. I'm being asked to heal my denial and my capacity to generate the emotion. If you go up to number one B, it was fear. You want to transfer that down here. I'm going to ask to be empowered to free myself of even the capacity to generate fear, no matter what happens in my world. Fear narrows the perceptual constructs of the mind and leaves us in corrupt data. So I'm asking for help to eradicate that from my life and from my bloodline. And then I ask to help an open, direct, conscious relationship with and gently remove the denied and dissociated parts of my carbon-based memory. So there's several things, and you know, it's a big mouthful the first time you do it, but there's several things over time that you'll see that you'll start to get assistance. And these things just starting to shift, like, gee, I didn't even do anything, and here's this change. And that's the power of this worksheet process. So how about just reading through that? I invite,
okay.
And, you know, in, say, for instance, AA groups, it's called the higher power, whatever term you have for it.
Well, I'll have a go with Rukka. Okay. I invite Rukka Dikudsha. Sorry, I've got to turn the page. To incline me towards healing, to restore my... what's a Rachma filter? And my gateway to the frontal lobes to maintain love, my newborn essence, heal my denial and capacity to generate the emotion of fear.
Okay. And help me to open.
And help me to open a direct conscious relationship. And gently remove the denied dissociated and projected parts of my carbon-based memory.
Now, the first time you do it, that's a big mouthful. Once you get used to it, it'll roll pretty easily. So you've done two things now. I've canceled my goal for Mr. Bulger to be of support and to be caring. And now I'm asking to clean up all the internal dynamics that I've created in my life around this. And let yourself take a breath and just be with that. And as you do, how do you feel?
Yeah, I do feel lighter.
Lighter, okay. So then in the next step, I now feel.
I now feel lighter.
And then when I think back to this situation in number one with Mr. Bulger, how does that look to me now?
I do feel bigger and taller and more able and more visible.
Awesome. Nice shift. So go ahead and make a note of that. That's powerful.
Yes. I might redo the worksheet when I watch back the thingy, the replay, because I've sort of written things down in a weird way, and I can't. It's much more difficult to write things when you're on the call than when you're watching.
Well, and you're in one of your issues. Here you are on the spot.
The issue
that you're working on is here you are, the one that's doing this whole process for everybody and, you know, being out there. So I understand that. And that's a nice shift to get, especially, you know, being right out there on the spot with that being your issue. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
I like that your language was so clear. It's like, I feel bigger.
Mm.
You're moving beyond the perceptions of a small child into the perception of an adult, into a different construct. And that's,
yes,
that's life-changing.
Yes.
Nice. Cool.
Thank you.
Okay. And then the next step seems so now you're looking at that particular goal,
yes,
and how it's impacted your life.
Yes.
You want to look at a time when you perhaps have violated that goal, when someone else wanted your love and support, and instead you did something different. So the last
well,
part.
That's probably my mum then, probably not being supportive to my mum while she's had all her operations.
Okay. So I'm going to write that down then. When I've not fulfilled the goal of being supportive, and that's been with mom. And as you say that, what feeling comes with that?
Well,
breathe.
It is a little bit anger as well. I'm withholding it on purpose to be a bit punishing, really.
Yeah.
Because she could have done something about it, but she never did either.
Mm.
So I think I get my own back.
Yeah. So here's your Hydra. So this I'd offer is one of your next worksheets.
Yeah.
To do one on mom.
Yeah.
And how you wanted her to do something and she didn't. That'll be the next one to do.
Okay.
That'll be another piece of the puzzle. And then the final step, step seven. A principle of the universe is that by giving, I first get the original. So I want to, one, tap into gratitude, as Yinka has shared with us in the opening, you know, when the groups get together to share something we're grateful for. There's been a lot of research done on the healing power of gratitude. So I'm grateful for this opportunity to heal. I choose truth and perfect love. We spoke about it in step two. I want to honor truth. Once again, I'm reminding myself that whatever my constructs are, if they're not based in love, it's a lie. It's corrupt data. And I'm willing to go for the truth. I'm willing to always be in the flow of love through me. In fact, you know, the best definition that I've been able to come up with in 50 years of developing this work is that life is love flowing through a cell. Anything that we do to inhibit love flowing through our cells is a step in the direction of self-annihilation.
Yes.
And so I want to tap into that flow and be in that flow. Truth and perfect love. There's a corresponding filter to Rachma that's in the frontal lobes of the brain. In Aramaic, there's a second filter over the perceptual part of the mind called Kuva. The two filters together were called perfect love. And you remember they said perfect love casts out fear. This, again, is a powerful psychological statement of truth. When Rachma and Kuva are set, it doesn't matter what you're facing in your world, your mind can't produce a fear-based reality. It's not possible. And that means that you're always in touch with the highest levels of intelligence possible for a human being, no matter what's going on in your world, if you're aware that you want to keep those two filters set. So that was called perfect love in Aramaic. So I want to tap in and acknowledge truth and perfect love. And then I'm talking now to the object of the worksheet, number 1C, Mr. Bolger. Mr. Bolger, based on number 3. So I'm going to do this goal setting. I'm going to set a goal toward him based on this goal that I'm dealing with of wanting to be supported by you and taught by you. I'm going to structure a truly loving goal toward you and offer you this. So now, I don't know, maybe Mr. Bolger's dead and gone. It doesn't really matter. But in your mind, is there something that anytime you think of him, you're willing to offer him? And or if you happen to walk down the street and meet him on the street, instead of the old energy that probably would have been claws out, what goal would you be willing to have toward him? This
smile. I will offer him a smile.
Yeah, nice. And notice when you do a smile what it does to your chemistry.
Yeah.
I get the original, they get the carbon copy. That's why Yeshua taught, have rachma when you think of neighbor. And interestingly enough, in the Aramaic language, the word neighbor means anybody that you think about.
Mm.
Not a physical word. It doesn't mean the guy down the block. The word neighbor literally means anybody that you think about. Anybody mentally near to you is your neighbor. And if you choose to stay connected to love, you've given yourself the gift of maintaining your human life. Whatever anybody else is, the worst person in the world, if you were facing them, you want to maintain your human life. You do that by maintaining rachma, perfect love.
Mm.
And you're at your most intelligent, you're most capable.
Mm.